Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It turns out that supporters of Senator John McCain got their wish after all. The Straight Talk Express never was shunted off to the roundhouse after the primaries in the year 2000. It remains very firmly on the rails. And the senator himself continues to attract new fellow travelers in his willingness to criticize Republicans and Democrats based on what they say or what they do, not based on their party affiliation. That kind of candor has political observers imagining new and greater roles for the senator from Arizona. But right now, his problem is the president's problem, and in fact, the whole country's problem. It's the war in Iraq. To go, to stay, to try once again to reestablish American honor, or to just make the best of bad work and figure out a quick and graceful way home. We invite you to talk with Senator John McCain this hour. We welcome your questions about the war, the prisoner abuse scandal, and the election that's underway. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I should mention that Senator McCain has written a new book. It's called appropriately, Why Courage Matters. And it will, I suspect, end up as a part of a number of points we touch on today. Senator McCain's joining us from a studio at the Senate building in Washington. Welcome back to The Connection. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Dick. It's good to be back with you.
I want to read you one of your own lines, this from a speech that you gave in late April. And it struck me, and I think we'll get us started off this morning. You said, Iraq is truly the test of a generation for America and for our role in the world. Faced with similar challenges, previous generations of Americans have passed such tests with honor. It is now our turn to demonstrate that our power, ennobled by our principles, is the greatest force for good on earth today. And I noted that, Senator, because it was barely a week later, I watched your face at the Senate Armed Services Committee and the anger and the frustration when you were talking with Secretary of Defense about the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, and wondered at the time, was that frustration that you felt something personal because of your own experience as a prisoner of war, or was it just watching the disappearance of America's principles of decency there?
It was the latter, Dick. My experience in prison was more than 30 years ago, and I had hoped that I'd judge issues and situations in light of my experience, knowledge, and position rather than something that happened to me personally. And I was frustrated with the Secretary's inability to answer what was really pretty straightforward and to the heart of the matter: who was in charge, what were the orders, what was the relationship between the guards and the military intelligence people, and who were these so-called private contractors. But more, far, far more than that, I worry very much about America's image in the world and our ability to carry out what I believe is our mission on Earth, and that is to help provide freedom and democracy to every person on this planet. And I don't mean through the use of bullets and Humvees, but through our example, through our commitment to observance of human rights, through our commitment to free and open society. And these pictures are being shown in prisons from Burma to Belarus. And I'm afraid that it impairs our ability to carry out our noble mission, and I worry about what the impact may be in the future.
Impairs America's ability, or in effect destroys America's ability to demonstrate those commitments?
I think it deals it a severe blow, but America has a long, long record of observance of human rights, of advocacy for human rights, and a record of punishing those who transgress. If we will take this all the way up the line to wherever it leads us and punish all who are responsible, then I think we are on the road to regaining some credibility. But
do you think it's enough to court-martial a handful of 20-year-old kids who appeared in those photographs, or do you think responsibility needs to go much further up the line here?
Every indication I see is that it goes further up the line, but I don't know how far, and I don't know the extent of it, and that's why we need to have hearings. And as I've continuously said, get it all out on the table, hold those who are responsible responsible as quickly as possible so that we can move on and begin again to repair the damage.
I want to read a passage just from the tail end of the book I mentioned earlier, your new one called Why Courage Matters. You're talking about a definition of courage as you see it in this country. And you're sort of speaking to the people when you say, have a care for your dignity. You're better than our enemies. You're not the kind of people who would murder to make a political or a religious point. Our enemies sacrificed their dignity to their hate when they took innocent lives deliberately, referring to September 11th. We have something essential to happiness that they do not possess, a sense of honor. Keep it. However much you are afraid, keep it. It's worth your courage to defend. And I read that and I thought to myself, so why not just look someone like Secretary Rumsfeld in the eye and say, you know, whether or not it goes all the way to your desk, isn't the demonstration and the protection of this honor worth a senior resignation before all the trials and court martials and everything are held? Someone to stand up and say, I'm taking responsibility, not just apologizing, but demonstrating it with a resignation.
I think you have an excellent point, Dick. I have wanted to see what all the facts are first, and I think that's appropriate. But I do believe that it's interesting that since 9/11, no one was responsible or held accountable, I guess. Everybody's responsible, so therefore no one is responsible. 9/11, the issue of weapons of mass destruction, where the President of the United States told the American people and our Secretary of State told the United Nations Security Council things that were not factual. And now, in this case, so far we've only identified a few privates or sergeants. I believe that responsibility needs to be allocated, but first I'd like to find out all the information. But I don't disagree with your fundamental point.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. First call now from Providence, Rhode Island. Stephen's on the line. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Hi, Senator Stephen. McCain, it's an honor to be on the line with you. I respect what you've said. I watched even your Meet the Press comments on Sunday with Senator Biden. My question, cutting to the chase, is when is enough going to be enough? When are you and our other senators on both sides of the aisle, when are House of Representatives members going to begin to draw their toes more firmly in the sand and begin to tell this administration in no uncertain terms the very kind of thing that you were alluding to on Meet the Press on Sunday, of here are the mistakes that have been made, but, you know, it's nice to have a president who's unbending. If he's unbending, going in the wrong direction, don't our legislators have some responsibility? And I'm not sure what the mechanics would be.
Be specific here, Stephen. What do you want the legislators to say?
Well, I think what's been argued by Senator McCain is we need to change course. Biden says president needs to lead. How do we get the president, how we get this administration to lead, and how do we clean house with the people who have made all these mistakes?
Well, I think that it's important to note that we are having hearings in the Senate Armed Services Committee. We will have another hearing tomorrow with General Abizaid, General Sanchez, and General Miller as witnesses. We need to continue these hearings and have them vigorous and detailed. I agree with you that Congress, to a large degree, as is somewhat understandable after 9/11, abrogated many of their responsibilities, particularly as far as monitoring expenditures is concerned. The administration came over last week and asked for a blank check of $25 billion to help pay for the war in Iraq, and we will put maybe not as tight as we'd like, but some restrictions on that spending, some accountability, some reporting procedures. The pendulum swings back and forth in this town. I think you're beginning to see the swing of the pendulum back in towards more of a demand for accountability while Congress exercises its legitimate oversight responsibilities, not privileges, over the expenditure of tax dollars. As far as policy is concerned, still pretty tough.
Stephen, thanks for that. Next to Raleigh, North Carolina, David's joining us on the line. David, go ahead.
Hello. Thank you very much for the opportunity. And I'm privileged to talk with you too, Senator McCain.
Thank you, David.
One thing that bothers me is that we're not having a discussion in public does not include something that I think it should include, and that is considering this taking us, the United States, taking the step that we will publicly treat all prisoners, or at least POWs in Iraq, with kindness. And by kindness, I mean you let them sleep, 8 hours a night. You let them pray. You let them read what they want to read. You feed them well and so forth. And all of them, I'm thinking even the ones who have information, because any potential information we can gain from these prisoners wouldn't be equal to what we would gain by being kind to all of them.
And David, you're saying the United States has not gone far enough in saying publicly to the world that these are the standards that are now in place in Abu Ghraib and other prisons. Is that the point?
And showing them. Well, I don't believe they are the standards. Rumsfeld, everybody is fighting to still maintain the ability to, we want some ability to squeeze these people. And I'm talking about publicly giving up all attempts to squeeze information out of people. You can discuss, you can talk with them, you can interrogate people, but you would interrogate them the way you would someone who has information that you want, not the way you would someone you hate.
Okay, David, let's hear from the senator.
Well, thank you. Dick, have you ever seen the movie The Battle for Algiers? It's a movie about the French and their treatment of Algerians in their long conflict there in Algeria. And the moral of the story is you can get information from people through the use of torture, but you alienate the population to a great degree, and thereby at the end of the day it becomes self-defeating. There's another aspect of the business of the treatment of prisoners of war. The main reason why I am so committed to the Geneva Conventions, as most of our military leaders are, is because I want Americans who should become captive, American fighting men and women who should become captive, to be treated according to the Geneva Conventions. I believe, therefore, we must also then treat Iraqi prisoners. And there is no doubt that these Iraqi prisoners are prisoners of war. It was a conflict. The Al-Qaeda, who have decided to kill innocent women and children at their, which is their strategy, they are a stateless terrorist organization. No, they don't have those protections. But they do have some human rights protections, and we've also signed a document about the use of torture. So there is a difference, and that difference has been blurred, at least it appears to me that it has. And I believe that we have to treat the prisoners according to the Geneva Conventions, which we are signatories to, and hope that we can enforce those conventions when Americans become prisoners in future conflicts as well as this one.
We're going to talk a little bit more about that when we come back after the break. A reminder that our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest for the hour, Senator John McCain, joining us from a studio in Washington, D.C. Your chance and mine to talk to the senator about the war, the prisoner abuse scandal, the election that's underway. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. John McCain, in his new book, talks about a sense of honor. He says a sense of honor encompasses all the virtues: justice, loyalty, honesty, compassion, and courage. It is concerned with more than one's own situation, one's own rights. It's concerned with the rights of others. But in the beginning, let them be proud. Let them care for their personal dignity. It's the first step in building their respect for the dignity of others and their empathy for those whose dignity is assailed. Appropriate words from the senator as we talk about the United States wrestling with the prison abuse scandal that's underway in Iraq. We invite you into our conversation this hour. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Senator, I want to go back to the point that David was making, because I think what he's expressing is this sense of real confusion in the country, that it's okay to stand up and say, well, Saddam Hussein, the man named as the world's worst thug and murderer, gets prisoner of war status and protection of the Geneva Convention, and the al-Qaeda people at Guantanamo are detainees or enemy combatants, and they don't. The insurgents in Iraq, well, who really knows what to do with them? And so what we're looking at now, and you're seeing it as well, is stuff in the paper from Seymour Hersh about who's actually calling the shots and whether or not it's coming from the CIA or whether or not it's the White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez rewriting the rules for the president. And I mean, how can America say this is what we stand for when Americans don't even know what they stand for, looking at all this confusion?
Well, you're right. It's got to be cleared up. I am particularly disturbed by the White House counsel's memorandum calling the Geneva Conventions as, quote, quaint, unquote. I didn't view them as quaint many years ago, and I'm sure those who are being held don't view them the same way. And I'm not sure what the White House counsel, very frankly, has to do with a lot of this. But anyway, there is confusion. It's got to be cleared up. And I think there may have been some confusion in the minds of some of the people who were involved in handling these prisoners. I think you have to remember, Dick, that last fall there was a dramatic uptick in the attacks on American troops, and there was a renewed pressure, an intense pressure, to get intelligence from these people who were prisoners so that we could try to stop these attacks, which were taking American lives and wounding them. And that's understandable. I mean, it's very understandable to try to want to have this intelligence. But that certainly doesn't excuse this kind of treatment. And I would also argue that if we as a nation condone such behavior, then we no longer distinguish ourselves from our enemies by our treatment of our enemies.
1-800-423-8255 to Framingham now, Massachusetts. And Jeff's with us. Jeff, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me on, and hello, Senator.
I'm
calling because I'm very concerned about the fact that it has been shown in articles by Seymour Hersh and in other ways that Secretary of State Rumsfeld has been calling the shots for what happened in Abu Ghraib. It's certainly more than the actual things that those kids did in the prison. They did it with the approval of elders. Now it looks like, and those higher up, and now it looks like it's been definitely shown that Rumsfeld was the one who was pushing ticket for them.
So what's your question here, Jeff?
So why isn't it being, why haven't you called for his censure, or at least his being called to task for it, or being even thrown out, or whatever it takes? I mean, Clinton was impeached or brought to impeachment. I think that this calls for the impeachment of President Bush, and as well for the dismissal of Secretary of State Rumsfeld.
All right, Jeff, take a breath.
Thank you.
The senator in here.
Well, thanks, Jeff. And obviously, you feel very passionate about this. I feel very passionate as well. But I believe that we have to have an orderly process here. As I mentioned, we're having another hearing tomorrow. I think we've got to have additional hearings. We need to get to the bottom of this. As far as Cy Hirsch's article is concerned, as I'm sure you know, the Defense Department has vigorously denied its authenticity, has said that no such thing exists, et cetera. We've got to get to the bottom of it. And it may mean that we may have to use subpoena power, which the Senate Armed Services Committee has. But I'd like to get all the facts out before we make judgments on individuals. But I also repeat what I said earlier in the program. The interesting thing about Washington today is that we're all responsible, so therefore no one is responsible. And by the way, that was true of the previous administration as well.
I should just mention for Cy Hirsch's sake that his work is appearing in The New Yorker, has been for successive weeks, and has been pushing this along with his work as an investigative reporter. I want to also return to a place where we were a little bit earlier in the program, Senator, and that is, you saying it's time we got all the facts out. You've really got to be watching the calendar when you do that, because in many ways, any attempt to try and hand over whatever the situation in Iraq is at the end of next month is going to depend on the way that the United States has responded to a lack of troops and to questions about the prison scandal. Can you wait? Can you wait until all the facts are out? Or does the United States, does the President, does the Secretary of Defense need to do something more dramatic ahead of that time?
I think the important thing is to prepare, which we haven't done at all well, for the handover of the government to Iraqis. That's a critical point, I think. You've seen the polling numbers that some 82% of the Iraqi people now resent the United States' presence. I don't believe they would resent our presence if Iraqis were governing Iraq with our help on security, which is very different from Americans governing Iraq. I'm not sure that this particular issue of the treatment of prisoners is as important to the Iraqi people as stability, security, and the belief that they are have their own government. They elections coming very shortly so that they would have their own elected government in power. But that doesn't change our obligation to get the information as quickly as possible. I've argued for two things. One is all the facts, and two, as quickly as possible. I've watched other scandals in this town, and in some respects it's a scandal where the drip system has gone on and on and on, and it has made the scandal far worse than it would have ever been if you just got everything out on the table as quickly as possible, and I continue to urge that.
We're going to Temecula, California next. Tony is joining us on the line from there. Tony, thanks for your call. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. Senator McCain, I'd like to say that I'm one of those independent voters that's never voted for a Republican, but if you ran for office, I probably would vote for you.
Thank you, Tony.
One of the few clear voices in the Republican Party.
Thank you, Tony.
You're welcome. I was born in 65, so I didn't get to experience what was going on with the Vietnam situation as an adult, so I could understand it very clearly. What I've learned since then is that we're not supposed to ever make those mistakes again. And I hear you say we need more troops in Vietnam. I'm not Vietnam. We need more troops in Iraq. And isn't that the same thing we were saying in Vietnam? We need more troops. We need more troops. I mean, isn't this just deja vu all over again?
I think not, Tony, in that in the case of Vietnam, they never had a legitimate government that the people could support. We were fighting a very popular insurrection led by a very incredibly charismatic and popular leader with significant and continuous support from superpowers, China and Russia, and a sanctuary from which the enemy could retreat whenever necessary. Now, after making all of those contrast, if we don't tell the American people the truth as to how hard this is, it's going to make it very difficult. And if we don't act vigorously, in my view, it's going to make it more difficult. I was over there last August. I came back after talking to so many people that approached me that we needed more troops at that time because we just didn't have control of places like Fallujah and others. And I was warned, and I therefore warned the administration that you're going to have an insurgency on your hands unless we have more troops over there. We're paying a very heavy price for that now in terms of American blood and treasure. I don't believe it has to be like Vietnam, and I would also argue that if we fail here, you and have to cut and run, unquote. I think the consequences of failure would be so significant that it would increase the magnitude over time of the war on terrorism to a significant and dangerous degree.
Though if we look ahead to, say, a month's time, if in a month's time there are still leading Iraqi politicians victim of car bombs, such as the one that, that we saw yesterday, if come close to the deadline at the end of June, the United States is no better able to promise a degree of security for the people there who might be brave enough to say, I'll take a crack at leading this country, then isn't it a further form of madness to say, right, hands off, you're in charge, good luck to the lot of you?
I'm not sure that's the option as I understand it, and that is that if there is still anarchy and still these attacks going on, we then would be then more required to provide security. But it would also be an indicator that we any hesitation in turning over the government, as fragmented and as ineffective as it may be, it's better than the state's rule of Iraq, because the Iraqi people at least would be governing themselves, and we could make the argument that the insurgents are fighting against an Iraqi government, not against the United States of America. Dick, I have never underestimated. I'm a student of history, not a very smart guy, but a student of history. We stayed in Japan for 7 years before we turned over the government there. What used to be East Germany and the Federal Republic of Germany still hasn't integrated into the rest of the country. Democracy is a very, very difficult proposition, but to not strive for it and not seek it for all human beings is a direct contradiction to our fundamental belief that all men and women are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. And I am an optimist, I'm an idealist, I'm an advocate of Wilsonian principles, and as I said before, I believe that we were put here on, that our noblest mission as the world superpower would be to help bring about freedom and democracy to every other nation. And again, I don't say that we do it with bayonets.
Tony, thanks for that call. Our number once again is 1-800-423-8255. Charleston, South Carolina. Patrick's on the line. Hi, Patrick.
Hello. Yes, Senator McCain. I wondered if you believe that the administration, the president and others, to continually call for catching people like Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden, dead or alive, contributed to the attitude of American soldiers in the prison situation.
Yes, but I think the major contributor is probably the indiscipline that existed in that prison and the lack of training and the lack of supervision and the lack of instructions. But on the larger issue, I also think that Americans were understandably outraged at the events of 9/11 and believe accurately that terrorists do not have the same protections as combatants do, in other words, the war in Iraq, and sometimes that distinction has been blurred, and I think that's one of the areas where that led us to the difficulties and problems we experienced in that prison. I thank you, Patrick.
If you were to be dragged into the White House and said, right, okay, you talk a lot about what would work over there, Senator McCain, so you're in charge for the next 6 weeks. What would you do in order to ensure that there would be some kind of peaceful handover of sovereignty? What would you do different in the next 2 months to ensure that some of that honor, some of that dignity that the United States may have lost could be restored, and also passed on, at least to a small degree, to the Iraqi politicians who will then take over?
I would do a variety of things, from making sure that all prisons are open to International Red Cross inspections at their will, in other words, on-site, unannounced inspections. Because they are such a respected organization, I would make sure that the troops and the interrogators observe those rules. I would make sure that those who are guilty are punished, no matter how far up it goes. But on a larger issue, I would go. I would not say that I'm going to go arrest or kill al-Sadr unless I was going to do it. I wouldn't say I'm going to go into Fallujah and punish those who killed 4 American citizens and dismembered their bodies unless I was going to do it. Napoleon once said, If you say you're going to take Vienna, take Vienna. And we are losing some credibility, and I would certainly not set up a militia that is composed of people who are recently fighting the United States. We want less militias, not more. And that, again, comes back to sufficient numbers of troops. We were going to go into a city of some 250,000 people with 1,500 Marines. That doesn't work. So I would find every available soldier, Marine, airman, whoever it is. I'd get them over there. I'd do what's necessary to bring about the pacification so that people can have security, and then they will be able to be interested in a good government. If people are in fear of their lives, they are certainly not as concerned about democracy as we might hope they would be. And finally, we're going to be there for a long time, and it's going to be a tough struggle, but it's worth it. I'd explain the consequences of failure, the benefits of success. And I find, Dick, I'd point out, we've been in South Korea for 50 years. We were in Germany. We're still in Germany for more than 50 years. We're in Bosnia. We're in Kosovo. We're in Afghanistan. Americans will stand for that and willingly help someone else obtain democracy and not be oppressed. But the casualty rate has to be manageable and brought under some kind of control, and that's really the key to it, and that's why security is so paramount.
Does it also mean, though, that someone at a senior level in the administration needs to make a more dramatic move to internationalize America's involvement there, whether it be NATO or the UN? Somebody need to eat some humble pie.
Oh, absolutely. We need the help. We need UN legitimacy. We need other allies. But much of that is for appearances' sake, to be honest, because there are not going to be that many countries who want to help us out in this difficult time. And whether that's legitimate or not, it's just a reality. It's still an American mission, but I would do everything in my power to internationalize it as much as possible.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest this hour is Senator John McCain. We are here and asking you to join our conversation as we take a look at the tense situation in Iraq, the still unfolding details of the prison abuse in that country and also in Afghanistan. And we'll get a chance to talk a little bit about domestic affairs when we come back, the election that is underway, whether or not the issues that we're talking about are being showcased and discussed in the proper way in this campaign. We'd like to have you with us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour is Senator John McCain, and we're talking in part about a new book that he has published. It's called Why Courage Matters, The Way to a Braver Life. There are places in the book when you can hear the senator back in his Navy whites. He asks the question, is an athlete's prowess and guts on the field an example of courage? Is suffering illness or injury without complaint courageous? He says a little bit later on, they may be steps along the way to acquiring courage, but of themselves, these acts, admirable though they are not sufficient proof of courage. A little bit later on, he says the idea from the book came from a creative editor who wanted to get some advice from the senator out to people after 9/11. And Senator, I'm not sure, but I get the impression that at this point in the book, this is you scribbling at high speed. Get on the damn elevator, fly on the damn plane, calculate the odds of being harmed by a terrorist. It's still about as likely as being swept out to sea by a tidal wave. Watch the terrorist alert and go outside again when it falls below yellow. Suck it up, for crying out loud. You're almost certainly going to be okay, and in the unlikely event you're not, do you really want to spend your last days cowering behind plastic sheets and duct tape? That's not a life worth living, is it, Senator?
No, it isn't. It's a little harsh, but in other parts of the book, we do talk about the virtue of it and the fact that, you know, we're raised to love and we love virtue, and we'll develop the courage to live virtuously. And courage is the willingness to sacrifice for love, and that's love of our ideals. And as you know, Dick, we tell a lot of stories about people that I've either known or admired throughout my life who have displayed this both physical and moral courage, or sometimes simply physical courage. In the case of Roy Benavides, a guy in Vietnam who performed so heroically that when President Reagan gave him the Congressional Medal, he said if they made a movie, nobody would believe it. Someone that you and I have both met, Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Peace Prize winner in Burma who continues to struggle for the independence of her people. And you know, a lot of our listeners know about her. I wonder how many know that her husband was dying of cancer, and he was in England, and she and the junta, the thugs that run that country, said, yeah, you can go be with your husband as he dies, but you can never come back. So she remained in Burma. I write about John Lewis, my personal hero, the civil rights leader who knelt near a bridge in Selma, Alabama, knowing he was going to get his head bashed in. You know, remarkable moral and physical courage. And all these people love something greater than themselves. Aung San Suu Kyi, it's independence. In John Lewis's case, it's social justice. And all of us need role models, and these people have been my role models, and I hope they will be to others.
1-800-423-8255 to Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Now Betsy's on the line. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. Senator McCain, I wanted to write you a letter because I was in Southern California last week. My daughter got her PhD at USC, and you spoke there exactly on the issue of courage. And I wanted to suggest to you, and I know how loyal you are to your party, but I wanted to suggest to you that you push your courage and your loyalty to the next step, and that you approach Senator Kerry, if he hasn't approached you, about running as his vice president, like Tony, who called earlier. I am not an independent. I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, but I would welcome the opportunity to vote for you. And I think that we have come to a point where this country is so divided, and we need some leaders of integrity, of courage, in whom we can trust, and that a Kerry McCain ticket would transform us. That I don't want to hear what you do for the next 6 weeks if you had the power. I want to hear what you do for the next 4 years if you were part of an administration. And I want to urge all of the listeners who agree with me to write to both you and to the Senator Kerry to say, please do this.
Well, thank you, Betsy. I appreciate that, and I congratulate you and your daughter on her receiving a PhD from a outstanding institution, University of Southern California, which, by the way, my wife attended, as well as my mother. And it's a wonderful school, and congratulations. I appreciate your kind remarks, and I appreciate those of many. I don't think it's best for the country for me to do that for a variety of reasons, and so therefore I have objected to it. But I do agree that this country is polarized in a way that I have never seen before. I've been in office for 22 years. I've never seen such partisanship. I've never seen such bitterness. The best example of that is we're fighting the Vietnam War all over again. Here we are in a war in Iraq that deserves our full attention and devotion, and we're refighting the Vietnam War. Who served and who didn't serve? Who was heroic? Who wasn't? I mean, it's just disgraceful, particularly for me, because it's offensive to me because I spent the last 30 years trying to heal the wounds of the Vietnam War, and here these people are reopening them again. Also, Betsy, if I were President of the United States or Vice President of the United States, which I will not be, I would start a reform. I'd reform the way that we govern. I'd reform Social Security. I'd reform Medicare. I would reform this odious business of pork barrel spending, which is driving us into the nation into bankruptcy. I would reform the revolving door where people bounce back and forth between government and high-priced lobbying jobs. I would institute a long series of reforms, both legislatively and macro issues. I would reform the military. And I think that history of this country is in cycles, and we are approaching the time where there's going to be a crying need for reform, much along the lines as it was in the days of my hero, Theodore Roosevelt.
And we are going next to Block Island, Rhode Island, and Jeff is with us. Jeff, what do you think?
Thank you, Dick, for having me. And Senator McCain, it's an honor to be on with you, with a politician and an individual of such integrity.
Thank you, Jeff.
An observation or a comment more than anything else. It seems to me in our country, this division between Republican and Democrat is we've lost the ability to have individuals who are for America, that put America first. You hear comments on TV. I think of something that former Secretary of State Kissinger said, where he said he served or worked for five presidents. I thought he worked for America. And it seems now we spend more time working for individual parties than we do actually for the good of the country. We divide ourselves into whether we're Democrats or Republicans, not Americans. And we're almost slipping into a parliamentary system in Congress where the heavy hands at the top on both parties come through and demand allegiance in exchange for funds on which to run.
I think you're. I agree, Jeff. I think a real good example of that is that I've been so severely criticized because I continue to state an obvious fact, and that is that John Kerry is a friend of mine. Some people find that surpassing amazing. My predecessor, Barry Goldwater, one of his good best friends in the Senate was George McGovern. In those days, that was an accepted practice to be able to have friendship that crossed the aisle. Now it's some kind of cardinal sin. But on the larger issue that you point out, that's right. And this gridlock has caused us to not work on issues which deserve nonpartisan attention. Social Security going bankrupt seems to me surpasses party lines. We should be working so that young Americans today who are hold jobs will receive the same benefits as present retirees receive. That's not the case. It isn't going to happen unless we reform it. Look at what we've just done to Medicare with this prescription drug program laid onto it, which was supposed to be $400 billion. We now find out is $540 billion, three months later on an already sick system, if I may use that that description. So it paralyzes us. Therefore, the American people don't get government to address the issues that are nonpartisan in nature. I can be as partisan as anybody on a number of issues, but unfortunately, this gridlock is now incapacitating us to a point where the only thing that they agree on is pork barrel spending.
Okay, so let's go back to the principles that were raised by Betsy's question. Jeff, thanks a lot for that. Mm-hmm. You say that you won't run as vice president on a Democratic ticket, that you support the president and his reelection. You also say that you have to respect the people in Arizona who voted for you as their Republican representative. You know, and I get all that. But what I don't hear from you is what you think about the principle of having two people from different parties on a ticket. Could you have a Democrat run on a Republican ticket if somehow that would break the kind of gridlock that we're talking about? Could you have a Republican running on a Democratic presidential ticket if that's what it took to say, you know what, the parties aren't the all-important creatures here?
I think that anything is possible. But either the Republican would have to become more like a Democrat in the case of the vice president, in case of my vice presidency, or vice versa. I think that there's a reason why we have a two-party system, and that is because we have differing philosophies as how our nation should be governed, and those are healthy differences and should be the subject to debate and discussion and elections. But I fear that what is necessary is not so much a Republican-Democrat ticket or Democrat-Republican ticket, is a demand to reform and throw some of the people out that act in such a partisan fashion that it hampers or prohibits us from acting on issues which we need to act.
But you know from your own work with campaign finance reform just how difficult it is to go against what's ingrained in Washington. That's something that you started years ago. You're still fighting that fight.
Yes, and I'm sorry to tell you that the pork barrel spending side of it, which is a major contributor to this massive deficit that is mortgaging our children's futures, is getting worse. In 1994, there was 4,000-some pork barrel earmarks on appropriations bills. This year, there's 14,000. And we're talking about $40, $50, $60 billion. That is a great deal of money no matter what. And also, the policy changes that are made in the dead of night without full debate and discussion. So the system is becoming more and more broken, in my view, to the point where I think there is going to be a reform movement in this country. What form that reform movement takes, I'm not sure, whether it's an outside party or within one party or the other.
I think what you're hearing from voters is a belief on their part that that kind of reform movement can only come from someone who has the kind of bipartisan credibility that you've established over your time in Washington there. I get a kind of sense from people that you know, if you're not going to take this on, that it probably won't happen. I'm going to give you one last line from your book here on this issue of joining a Democratic ticket. This from a woman you admire considerably, Eleanor Roosevelt. And you quote her saying, "Senator, you must do the thing you think you cannot do."
I understand that, Dick, and I believe that the question is, where can I be most effective? You know, vice presidents of the United States, with the exception of Dick Cheney, are notoriously ineffective. There's an old line that the vice president has two duties. One is to break a tie in the case of a vote in the Senate, and the other is to inquire daily as to the health of the president. I believe I have established a position in my state and nationally where I can affect national policy in a broad variety of issues. I will continue that struggle, and it means from time to time I go against my party, not on principle, but on practice. And I believe in Abraham Lincoln. My hero is Theodore Roosevelt. And I hope I have the opportunity to continue to serve. All this is very, very transient. This is my crowded hour, as T.R. used to say, and I believe that I can best serve by not doing it. But don't think I hadn't thought about it. Don't think I haven't been tempted in many ways. Don't think that I would love to see do whatever is necessary to bring this nation back together. But I have just, over time, grown to believe that it's not the option where I could be most effective for the good of the country. And I'm not getting any younger, my friend.
Senator McCain, it's wonderful to have you on the program. Thanks for your time.
It's great to be back with you, Dick. I've always enjoyed our exchanges.
Will you give our best regards to your wife, Cindy, who I gather is at home, at a hospital, and doing all right?
Yes, she's doing very well. Thanks to everyone for their thoughts and prayers on her behalf.
My guest this hour, Senator John McCain, author of a new book, Why Courage Matters, The Way to a Braver Life. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.